Well, good morning, everyone. If you were looking for session 3167.0, you're in the right place. This is Emerging Theories and Promising Practices in Health Promotion. And on behalf of the Public Health Education and Health Promotion section, it's my pleasure to welcome you this morning to this exciting session. My name is Elaine Ault, and I'm with the Society for Public Health Education here in Washington, also active member of the Public Health Ed section. And we'd like to invite you to become more involved in our section by attending one of our business meetings over the next couple days, stopping by the booth in the exhibit hall, or by emailing a member of the section leadership, which is on the Public Health Education and Health Promotion section website link of APHA. We're actually the, I believe, still the largest section within APHA. So we have a lot of dynamic activities going on, and I invite you to check it out. And also come to our section social tonight if you'd like to see who some of the leaders of the section are and meet them, ask them questions about how you can become more involved. Well, the context for our session today is really to take a step back. Over the last 30 years or so, when our field was really developing, we had a lot of theoretical constructs and theories, paradigms that were shaped around certain white populations. And we know demographically our nation is changing dramatically. And we really need to take a step back and look at how some of those previous models may or may not apply and what new emerging models or constructs are on the horizon that we need to adopt in our public health education practice and research. So we have two excellent speakers this morning, one coming from the behavioral sciences and health education paradigms, and one also coming providing us some insights from the health communications perspective as part of this session. And we really hope that we'll have enough time, we think we will, to engage your perspectives, both as researchers and practitioners, on what you are seeing on the front lines of your work. Our first speaker is Dr. Michelle Kegler. Dr. Kegler is trained in health behavior and health education and has about 25 years of experience in community-based chronic disease prevention. Her research interests include community coalitions, evaluation of community-based health promotion programs, and how environments, both social and built, influence tobacco use, physical activity, and healthy eating. She's an associate professor in the Behavioral Sciences and Health Education Division at the Rollins School of Public Health, Emory University in Atlanta, and she's director of the Emory Prevention Research Center, which focuses on preventing cancer and reducing health disparities in Southwest Georgia. Dr. Kegler is also a PI for the Emory Cancer Prevention and Control Research Network, which disseminates evidence-based cancer prevention and control in rural Georgia. She's also a lead evaluator for the Gates Foundation Tobacco Control Project in China. So you can see she gets around quite a bit. Also, last but not least, she is a co-editor of a textbook that some of you may have been familiar with or have on your bookshelf called Emerging Theories in Health Promotion Practice and Research. Michelle?
Thank you, Elaine. Good morning, everybody. I'm going to talk today about some organizational change theories, and I'll try to emphasize the implications of these theories for our field, health education and health promotion. I was on this panel last year and talked about community coalitions and community partnerships, and when Elaine asked me to come back, I thought I needed a new topic. So my expertise is a little less deep on this topic, and I would like to have you think about my presentation as just presenting some new ideas, ways of thinking about things, and then hopefully we can have a discussion and other people with expertise in organizational change can chime in. And I think we have enough time because we just have the two speakers. Right, Elaine? Okay. I believe I'm supposed to say that I have no relationships to disclose related to this presentation. So as health educators, I think most of us have realized we need to think beyond knowledge, attitudes, and health beliefs in order to promote health. For the most part, we've all embraced a social ecological perspective where we understand that there are multiple levels of determinants that influence individual behavior. So it's individual level factors, interpersonal, organizational, community, and policy. Our intervention strategies and our theories, though, still focus heavily at the individual level and interpersonal levels. And I think that's because our theories and a lot of our early leaders came from psychology and have a perspective that's a little more individual focused. And we're still trying to shift away from that, I think, as a field. I think probably many of you are familiar with these phrases up here. Make healthier choices, easier choices, make healthy options the default choice, create environments in which people can be healthy. Do they sound familiar to you all? Yes? I think that in order to actually do those, turn those phrases into reality, we need to do a better job of understanding how to change organizations. And so that's what I'm going to try to talk about today. Organizational change reaches larger numbers for less cost than individual change. It also requires less dependence on individual behavior change in order to achieve health outcomes. So I'm talking about organizational changes like requiring physical education in the schools, replacing unhealthy foods and vending machines at work sites with healthy foods, banning or mandating smoke-free environments in a range of settings, from schools to work sites to parks and bars. And all of those changes we don't have control over as health educators. We have to convince, persuade, encourage organizations to make these sorts of changes, and it would be helpful to think about the processes for how we do that. How many of you have seen this? Okay, over half. I just thought I'd highlight this since this is the Health Impact Pyramid developed and promulgated by the director of CDC, Tom Frieden. And he and CDC actually these days is encouraging interventions more at the bottom of this pyramid, believing that they have increased population impact and less individual effort is required to achieve population health if we choose intervention strategies at the bottom of this pyramid. So it's acknowledging that social determinants are the biggest contributor to public health issues, labeled socioeconomic factors here, changing the context to make individual defaults decision healthy is at the second level of the pyramid, and that's where I think organizational change can fit. If we can convince organizations, persuade organizations, to some extent mandate organizations to set up healthy environments, we can achieve some level of population health with less effort than trying to have programs and get everybody to come to our five sessions at the local health center. How many of you are familiar with CDC's community transformation grants? Excellent. Many of you probably spent last spring working on them, and hopefully at least some of you achieved success. Any grantees in the audience? Oh, one. Congratulations. You're in a small group in the room. So I think you're probably all familiar with that RFA, or those of you that raised your hand, and it had a really strong emphasis on policy and environmental change, and a lot of the requirements focused on changing organizations. And I just listed a couple of the strategic directions from that request for applications. And so grantees are required to implement smoke-free schools and campuses, increase availability and affordability of healthful foods in a variety of institutional settings, and increase policies and practices to support breastfeeding in a range of organizations. So again, this new initiative requires lots of organizational change, because it was largely health departments, I think, that were funded, and they aren't in a position to force all those organizations to do health promotion. They have to do it through collaboration and other methods. There's definitely room for improvement in making organizational environments healthier. This is just a little bit of data from a survey we did in the Emory Prevention Research Center. We surveyed 300 and some rural residents in southwest Georgia and asked about their worksite health promotion environment. And you can see the percentages are somewhat low in terms of healthful environments. So the first few items are health promotion programs, and you can think of programs as an organizational policy, a policy or a decision to offer health promotion programs to your employees, and about a quarter of the organizations offered some kind of health promotion program. We also asked about exercise facilities, and only about a quarter had an exercise facility at work. And we asked about healthy food, or even food in the work environment. About 48% reported that they had a cafeteria, but then only 56% of the 48%, which is about 27%, reported that there were healthy foods available in the worksite. So still quite a bit of room for improvement, even though we've been working in this area for a good 10, 15 years in health education. And I don't know how representative that is, but it's rural Georgia. So what organizational change theories do we use in health education? I've been a co-author on the organizational change chapter in the Health Behavior, Health Education textbook on theory that's edited by Karen Glanz, which most people that go through a master's program use. And that's been a challenging chapter to write for the last 15 years. And I think that's because we don't have a lot of health educators who are actively either developing theories in organizational change and or doing scans to other disciplines and other fields to find out what could we borrow and adapt for our particular field. And so what we usually talk about in that chapter is stage theory of organizational change and organizational development theory, which are absolutely fine and useful, but it just feels like we could really make some significant improvements in this area, and then we probably need to. Diffusion of innovation, of course, everybody knows that theory, and that definitely applies to organizational change as well. So let me just refresh your memories, because it might be a while since you've read that chapter, or else you've never read it. The stage theory is like many of our stage theories. This is at the organizational level, though, so there's four stages: awareness, decision, implementation, institutionalization. And so awareness is when an organization begins to realize, you know what, we could probably do things better. Let's think about how to make a change. The decision is obvious, the decision to adopt an intervention or an innovation. Implementation usually involves changing the intervention so that it better fits the organization and or changing the organization a bit so that it can embrace the innovation or the intervention. And then institutionalization is attempting to make the intervention a permanent part of the organizational structure. Organizational development theory is more of a process, and it's the second theory I just want to refresh folks on. And these stages are very, very familiar to health educators. It's basically the program planning process where you make a diagnosis, develop an action plan, do an intervention, and evaluate the results. It's just within an organizational context. And so the diagnosis involves some sort of assessment, usually, understanding the organizational context of the organization and kind of what the pressure points are and what could be improved to make the organization more efficient or better able to meet its goals. And then action planning is our kind of action planning, implementing the intervention, and then evaluating. Evaluating is real important to have feedback loops so that you can see if the intervention was successful in achieving change and then modifying it if it wasn't. So those are nice theories. I feel like, however, there's still more that we need to learn, and here are just some questions that I generated while preparing this presentation, and in the discussion point, it would be nice to have some dialogue about what else we need to learn about organizational change. So what I listed was, how do we reach organizations to adopt health promotion practices? If you're a health educator at a county health department, how are you going to reach out to all the work sites in your county and try to get them to engage or implement health promotion policies? How do we influence organizations from where we sit in a community? How do we introduce new practices to an organization? How do we build capacity within organizations to implement the change? How do we identify, work with, and support change agents? There are often people within organizations that want to engage in the health promotion activity, whatever it is, and how do we support them if we're from outside the organization? And then how do we influence or help structure the process of implementation from outside? At this point, I'd like to be clear that I don't have the answers to all these questions. And anybody that does or even has ideas, I'd like to discuss that after the presentation as well. I have, however, learned about this new model that I thought would be worth sharing. And I want to acknowledge how I even know about this. I haven't discovered it on my own, but I'm part of the Cancer Prevention and Control Research Network, which is 10 universities funded by CDC and National Cancer Institute to study the dissemination process for evidence-based cancer prevention and control efforts. And so we've been trying to think through, if we're going to study dissemination of cancer control evidence-based interventions, what theoretical framework should we use? And we've settled on this one, which is called the Consolidated Framework for Implementation Research. And so I got to thinking about the topic of this presentation and thought, well, maybe that's a useful framework to get us to think a little bit differently or a little bit more broadly about organizational change. This comes from health services research, so it's not generated from within our discipline. So if we embrace this, it would be borrowing and adapting from health services research. So it has that little bit of a healthcare focus, but I think a lot of it does generalize. It was published in Implementation Science in 2009. And whenever I mention the Cancer Prevention and Control Research Network, I'm also supposed to mention that that's a program funded through the Prevention Research Center's program of CDC. So this isn't a theory like our usual theories. It doesn't have a lot of boxes and arrows. It's a little more organic than that. The authors say that it's really a typology or a framework rather than a specific theory that you can generate hypotheses from. What they did was collect up 30, 40, 50 models, frameworks, and theories in organizational change focused on implementing change within organizations. And they pulled out the constructs that were repeated over and over and over in all of these models, hoping that people would buy into this and begin to use these terms and these definitions so that we can collect an evidence base about organizational change. So they identify five domains, and some of these are familiar from diffusion of innovations, but I think this approach goes more in depth in a particular organization rather than looking at spreading across organizations. The domains are intervention characteristics, and that's really all the details about the intervention itself, the outer setting, that's all the factors that are external to an organization. Inner setting is the factors internal to an organization. This theory acknowledges that the people within the organization matter a lot, and I'll talk about that a little bit more, but kind of not viewing an organization as a black box, but digging in and realize there's a lot of people stuff going on within organizations that affect implementation, and then the process that's used to introduce an innovation to an organization. So instead of boxes and arrows, this is the model, and I'll explain just a few of the key pieces. You can see over on the left is the intervention. So let's use a concrete example just to make this a little more real. Let's say a county health department got a grant from CDC, and they're trying to make college campuses in their county smoke-free. So our innovation is a smoke-free college campus. Okay? The core elements of that intervention might be no smoking anywhere at any time. So that would mean no smoking in the dorms, no smoking in the buildings, no smoking in the hospital if it has a health sciences center. Patients can't smoke, patients' families can't smoke. No smoking anywhere. And maybe there's also a smoking cessation program for employees who are trying to quit. Maybe there's also, we did this recently at Emory, DeKalb County, where Emory is located, got money from CDC to try to make all college campuses smoke-free, so they had as one of their objectives to make Emory, where I work, smoke-free, which was interesting, and we're actually going to do it, but it was definitely a process. And so there might be some optional parts of a smoke-free campus as well, perhaps referrals to cessation clinics, or at Emory we're instituting a user fee where people that smoke need to pay $50 for as part of their health insurance. So that might be part of this policy or not. But anyway, the idea is there's core elements or core components to a policy, and then there's optional parts of an intervention. the outer setting and the inner setting, you can see that line is jagged, and that's just to make the point that that line isn't always clear. The boundaries are sometimes hard to set between where an organization ends and the community starts. The hatch marks in the inner setting are to represent that organizations are complicated. They have hierarchies, they have networks, they have formal communication, they have informal communication, they have cultures, they have climates, and all of that is at play when you try to introduce an innovation. And then the process line is a lot of little curly cues that go this way and that way. There's multiple processes happening at once, a lot of changes going on in organizations all at once, and you have to fit your implementation process within that context. And then it shows on the right side that the intervention, when successfully implemented in an organization, fits nicely. There's no more white space there, so both the organization and the intervention have been adapted and molded to each other, so both have been changed. So I'm going to run through each of these domains somewhat quickly, and I think I'm allowed to go over my 20 minutes because there's just two speakers, so I'll try not to go too much longer than that for discussion purposes. So these are the constructs related to the characteristics of the intervention, and you can see some of them are what you would see in diffusion of innovation, but really the intervention source, where'd the idea come from? What's the strength of the evidence that supports the intervention? How does it compare to what we're doing now? What's the relative advantage of making this change? Can we adapt the intervention? Can it be changed, or do we need to do it exactly as it was presented to us? Can we try it out? Can we pilot test it? How complex is it? Can our staff understand it? Can we implement it? What's the quality of the packaging or the design of the intervention? That's a problem with a lot of the research we do. We do intervention research studies posted on a website and then expect practitioners to adopt it when we haven't really packaged it in an understandable, user-friendly way. And then what's the cost of the intervention? Now, there's a few interesting points that interventions typically do not fit well within an organization unless they're changed to fit the context, and that I've already mentioned interventions have the kind of core essential components that have to be done in order to achieve effectiveness, and then some tailoring can be allowed. But it's kind of a question as to what can be tailored and what has to be done just as originally designed. And so research on this domain suggests that the source of the intervention, whether it comes from outside an organization or inside, so in our example, the idea is coming from the County Health Department, not Emory University. The transparency of the decision to adopt, who's making that decision and why, and are they open about it to the full organization? And how much user input is provided or solicited or obtained into the decision to implement an intervention? What are the sources of evidence? Is it something that's mentioned in the community guide after a systematic review? Have there been randomized controlled trials or rigorous evaluations of it? Is it something that Georgia Tech or Georgia State did, and so Emory wants to do it? You know, what is the evidence? And research shows that the more different types of evidence there are, the more likely implementation is to occur. An intervention that can be modified is positively associated with implementation. So if there's a little bit of room for an organization to change the intervention to make it better fit them, that's more likely to be successful. If there's an ability to roll it out slowly, to pilot test it, to do a dry run, that helps with implementation. And then if it's a very complex and costly intervention, it's less likely to be embraced, which we would expect. So the outer setting, this is the external environment, external to the organization. This includes the economic, political, and social context with which an organization resides. So for Emory, that would be DeKalb County, the Atlanta metro area, our peer institutions around the country would be the different environmental contexts, the economy, policies, funding situations, all of that. The actual constructs, and this is where you can see that it comes a little bit more from, the original theory comes a little bit more from healthcare. They focus on patient needs and resources. So in extrapolating that to the kind of work that we do more often, I'm thinking that might mean future students, students' families, professional colleagues around the country. Cosmopolitanism is the extent to which an organization is connected to the outside community. So you can have insular organizations, which are very internal focused. Cosmopolitanism is an organization that's well connected nationally or internationally or even in the community. Peer pressure is what our peer institutions doing. And external policy and incentives for an institution like Emory might be accreditation, positive press coverage, visibility as a health leader, funding from the county health department. Research on outer settings suggests that organizations with boundary spanners are more likely to implement new interventions. So this means that there's people in an organization who are connected to the cutting edge thinking. And in health education, we form a lot of coalitions and community partnerships, and we have a lot of organizational representatives on our coalitions. And so to an extent, we're pretty good at forming boundary-spanning roles to allow people in an organization to get a little bit outside their organization so that they can bring new ideas in. Implementation is more likely when competitors and peers and other organizations have already adopted an intervention. And when external incentives and pressures increase, that helps with motivation, makes an organization feel like, yes, we need to make this change or we're going to be behind the times, but it doesn't necessarily build capacity to implement the change. Inner setting is all the stuff going on within an organization, so it's the organizational structure, the org chart, the networks and communication, the culture, the climate for implementation, and the readiness for implementation. So it includes the structural, political, cultural context, all of which a policy, when it's being implemented, is going to need to deal with. So our smoke-free campus example, in order to get a smoke-free campus at Emory, all of those internal factors are going to be affected and affect the policy implementation. Research suggests that the number of units that participate in decision-making affects implementation, so that's consistent with sort of the health education view of inclusivity and consensus decision-making. High-quality communication, both hierarchical, so at a university it might be the president, the deans, the faculty senates, the student government's body, the formal structure, you want that to be strong in terms of communication, as well as the informal horizontal communication networks. If those are strong, that's and supportive of the intervention, then implementation is more likely. There needs to be a tension for change. The greater the tension for change, the greater the implementation. So that means, from our perspective, creating arguments so an organization feels like they need to do our policy or our environmental change. So for smoke-free campuses, it'd be trying to convince decision makers at Emory that campuses all across the country are going smoke-free. It's positive for these reasons. It's hurting Emory for these reasons. And trying to create some tension or some desire to create the change. And then readiness for implementation includes leadership engagement, resources to implement it, and access to how to actually do it and why it's important. And that matters in terms of successful implementation. So the last construct is second to last construct is characteristics of individuals. And I'm not going to spend much time on this. These are, and it's interesting that they use a lot of the same constructs that we use in our work. So you see self-efficacy, you see stage of change, you see theory of planned behavior. So this is sort of our traditional domain here. And they also point out that there's not much research, and I think it's true, on how individuals interact with their organizations. So how, when you have individuals with high self-efficacy and an advanced stage of change, how do they work their organization to actually create organizational change? And then how does the organization in turn affect them, either positively by supporting the change and the innovations that they want to bring to the organization, or depressing them and making them give up because it's just too hard a culture to create change in. And then the last domain is also one we're pretty familiar with in health education, health promotion, and that's the planning process. So planning, engaging users and decision makers in the process, executing or implementing, and then reflecting and evaluating. This requires an active process. Change doesn't just happen in an organization. Someone needs to think it through and lead it. And it can be planned or spontaneous, linear or nonlinear. And so research in this domain also is familiar to us. There's several types of change agents, and I think as health educators we need to think about the sort of change agents that we're cultivating and think broadly about it. And so they identify opinion leaders, which we're familiar with, formally appointed implementation leaders, champions, and external change agents, which might be, in our example, the health department person. So well-developed implementation plans, dry runs, pilot tests, and feedback on how implementation is going and what impact it's having on the organization, positive and negative, is associated with successful implementation. So I think this model and similar models, there's a lot of models that include these same sets of constructs, would be useful to us if we could think strategically about their implications for our work. And I have a list of implications that I just generated and would like discussion on in a minute. There are some additional theoretical developments that you just kind of hear about in our field. I don't think we've embraced them yet, and maybe they're not ready for prime time yet. But one that people are talking about a little bit more is systems theory and systems thinking. You might remember there was a theme issue of American Journal of Public Health in 2006 that was devoted to systems thinking. And the main ideas there that I think are relevant to us, although they're not real concrete, is the idea of not always dissecting things into individual variables, but acknowledging the whole system, obviously. It really focuses on relationships and connections between points. It has a strong emphasis on context. And then also that not everything is linear. When we're trained as in our research classes, I think we're trained to think of linear regression and that these variables predict this and everything goes in one direction. Well, life, as I think we know it if we think a little bit, is a little more complicated than that, with everything affecting everything. That just doesn't always work with our statistical model, so it doesn't always show up in our theories. And this is an acknowledgement that, you know what, the world is complex. We need to start dealing with it instead of always simplifying. Organizational readiness. There's been some work done on that, and that can be viewed as a construct within the model that I just presented. And then social network analysis, that's been around for a long time, but we haven't used it that much at the organizational level, and I think we should start doing that a bit more. And I'm going to present an example from my own work on that. This is an organizational network in Ottawa County, Oklahoma, and it's 8 or 9 tribes and the schools in the county and the public health and environmental health agencies. And so we drew our boundaries around organizations that we thought should be working on lead poisoning prevention activities. And this is an area that was severely contaminated with mine waste and at the time had a high percentage of children with elevated blood lead levels. And so when we began the project in 1997, this is what the organizational network looked like. And you can see over on the left is all the agencies. And they're pretty well networked. They form a star shape, so everybody's communicating with everybody, although there is an organization in the center. And then you can see, I think it's Tribe D, if you come over to the right. There's one tribe, and then all the other tribes are on the other side of that tribe. So what that means is that tribe was really a gatekeeper. And it was the organization that was interacting with all the public health and environmental health agencies. The other tribes weren't terribly connected to the public health infrastructure. You can also see some tribes and other organizations listed on the top corner, and they weren't engaged at all with anybody in this network related to lead poisoning prevention. And so as a health educator, this gives you some insights into what you should do in order to build collaboration and build some momentum around your health issue. In our case, it was lead poisoning prevention. Clearly, we needed to make more connections between the public health infrastructure and the tribes. And we also needed to somehow engage those tribes that weren't in the thick of things in terms of lead poisoning prevention. And so 2005, 8 years later, this was the same set of organizations, and this is how they were networked. And all of a sudden, it's hard to pick out where the tribes are relative to the public health agencies. And there aren't any tribes that are disconnected anymore. Everybody's connected. And so this was helpful both in planning purposes, and then we used this as part of our evaluation to show that collaboration and community capacity had increased as a result of the intervention, which was creating opportunities for tribes to get more engaged in the environmental health issue, both through community advisor boards, and we used a lay health advisor intervention that involved tribal members. So here are just my own brainstorming thoughts on how we can use some of this information in health education. And if we have time, I'd like to get other ideas as well. Some of these are really obvious. Some of them are a little less obvious. But in terms of the intervention characteristics, I think we need to do a better job providing a range of evidence to convince organizations that what we want them to do is good for them, that makes sense. You know, in my work, we often say, well, it's an evidence-based practice listed in the community guide. Well, organizations haven't always heard of the community guide, so we might need a little bit more of a compelling argument there. And I think we need study results, rigorous evaluation results, systematic reviews of that, but I think we also need stories, narratives, examples of peer institutions or peer organizations that they know about that have implemented the change and done it successfully. I think we need to package materials in a user-friendly way. Researchers often just stop once they get their paper published, but they still expect practitioners to pick up the intervention, and now that there's this mantra of evidence-based interventions, practitioners are looking more than ever for, okay, so you want us to do this evidence-based intervention. Can you tell us how we're supposed to do it? What are the core components? What are the materials? How come they're 15 years old? You know, a little more effort in that area, I think, would be wise. Develop implementation manuals so people know, okay, so we're going to try to make Emory smoke-free. What does that mean? What do we do? Should we form a task force? Who should be on it? How often should they meet? What should their agenda be? Do we have a model policy? What are the pieces? You know, just really lay it out for people in a friendly, easily accessible way. The outer setting, I think we as health educators or health promoters can create these boundary spanner roles. I think we should more aggressively and assertively try to get input from organizations, have them engaged in our action planning groups, our prioritizing, and that will expose them to ideas, plus make them feel a little more obligated to implement health promotion efforts, I think. We should promote and publicize the success of early adopting organizations to build peer pressure on the other organizations within a community. And we could think about offering incentives for adoption. At the Emory Prevention Research Center, we're using mini grants, small amounts of money, but it's enough to get organizations to apply for the money, and then what they have to do is implement an evidence-based intervention. And so we talk them through how to adapt it to their particular organizational culture. So small incentives can go pretty far. The inner setting, I think we need to think creatively about the range of change agents and realize that there's different kinds of change agents, and we should be thoughtful as to who we approach within an organization. We need to pay attention to who's involved in the decision-making. Often we get so excited that an organization is going to, you know, change out the unhealthy foods in their vending machines that we don't pay attention or provide any technical assistance or consultation on the process of making that change, because we want that change to last, not just be for this school year. I think we should utilize formal and informal communication channels within organizations, so spend some time getting to know your partner organizations and how they operate, make decisions. And then I think we need to provide arguments or build cases for the tension for change, and so that a change agent that you do encounter within an organization is able to go home and argue in her home institution why this change is important. We're already pretty good at changing individuals, I think, so we know how to build knowledge, skills, and self-efficacy of change agents and implementers, but I think we need to take that mentality, which we often have in our health education programs, our patient education programs, and think about applying that same set of practices to organizational change agents. And then we should support a full change process. I think we often want to introduce an innovation to an organization, but sometimes we stop there, and we don't provide assistance on how to implement the change, how to evaluate the change, how to have feedback loops, how to pilot test. We could do a better job of those phases of organizational change, and then encourage sites to build in pilot test phases. So that was my last slide. I think after Kelly talks, or I don't know quite how we're going to do that, but I'd like to have a discussion of these kinds of questions. If you can think of any additional implications for this set of theories for our practice. whether there are any specific intervention strategies. I was trying to think, what actually do we do as a field to promote organizational change? And what came to mind for me was coalitions and community partnerships and academic detailing. But I'd like to hear other processes that people are using to get organizations to do what we want them to do. Are there other useful theories that people have encountered and been able to use successfully in organizational change? And then what other research is needed in order to help health educators facilitate this kind of organizational change? And I'll stop there.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.